ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 10th of September. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Israel's launched audacious strikes within Qatar, targeting Hamas leaders, with the militant group confirming five of its members were killed. Qatar has condemned the attacks as cowardly and a violation of international law. It had been trying to negotiate a ceasefire in the Israel-Gaza war and is an ally of the United States. The White House says it tipped off Qatar to the impending strike, but Doha disputes this. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran is in Jerusalem and we spoke earlier.
Sabra, good morning. Around 5 o'clock local time, there were reports of explosions in a suburban part of the Qatari capital, Doha. And shortly after, the Israel Defense Forces and Shin Bet, the domestic intelligence agency, announced that it had struck Hamas's leadership. Six people were killed in these strikes. One of them is a Qatari security services officer, but the other five are members of Hamas, including the son of the chief negotiator. But Hamas is insisting its leadership has survived. We don't know if they're injured or not, but Hamas is certainly insisting here that Israel hasn't achieved its goal. Even with that assessment, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is heralding the mission as a great achievement. He was speaking about the attack shortly after it happened at an event hosted by the US Embassy in Jerusalem.
They perpetrated the worst attack on the Jewish people since the Holocaust. Now, they were meeting in the same place, exactly the same place, where they celebrated this savagery almost 2 years ago. At the beginning of the war, I promised that Israel would reach those who perpetrated this horror. And today, Israel and I have kept that promise.
That's Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And Matthew, what about the United States? Did it have any involvement or knowledge of this?
Well, Sabra, it's quite important to note what the White House has said, or in fact hasn't actually said here about the strike. We've got a bit of Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary, passing on the president's assessment here.
Unilaterally bombing inside Qatar, a sovereign nation and close ally of the United States that is working very hard and bravely taking risks with us to broker peace, does not advance Israel or America's goals. However, eliminating Hamas, who have profited off the misery of those living in Gaza, is a worthy goal.
That's Carolyn Leavitt, the White House press secretary. Now, it's important and telling what she couldn't or wouldn't say just after that. She said that the US military told the White House this strike was about to happen. She wouldn't say whether the Israeli military had told their counterparts in the Pentagon. Now, the reason that's important is that it goes to how the US learned of this attack. Was it expressly told, or did it detect the attack was about to happen, given its own heavy military presence in Qatar? Beyond that, Carolyn Leavitt says the White House's special envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, picked up the phone to alert the Qatari government. Qatar, in expressing its overall fury at this strike, is saying that advance notice wasn't actually made, that the explosions were being heard as that call from Steve Witkoff came in. We know that President Donald Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke after the strike. Carolyn Leavitt says that the US president made his views clear, but she's not commenting on whether he was frustrated with the Israeli Prime Minister.
And what are the ramifications of this attack across the region?
Well, Sabra, it quite literally blows up the ceasefire talks between Israel and Hamas. This has targeted Hamas's negotiating team, and it is a strike which has happened on the soil of a country which has been acting as a mediator in the war in Gaza. Qatar and Egypt fulfilling that role for the duration of this conflict now. This strike also threatens the stability across the broader Gulf region. It is showing that Israel is increasingly belligerent. We know Israel has attacked other countries in the neighbourhood in recent times, be it Lebanon, Syria, Iran, or the Houthi rebels in Yemen. It has not ventured into the Gulf in this way before, and it is certainly giving an impression that Israel thinks anything is fair game here.
Matthew Doran in Jerusalem. There's shock and confusion in Qatar at the Israeli attack. With more, here's Nicole Johnston.
Khalid is a Qatari national in Doha. He always believed he lived in a safe, peaceful country. But this attack by Israel on the leadership of Hamas has stunned him. He sent us this voice message shortly afterwards.
There was this thunderous loud noise when I was in a hotel listen to it. It was just continuous several times. I think people are on edge. They're a bit shocked. And maybe a lot of people are staying indoors for now.
Qatar's government has condemned the attack, calling it a cowardly criminal assault. Majid Al-Ansari is spokesperson for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
The Israeli attack that took place today on the state of Qatar, we can only call it as state terrorism that is being exerted by someone like Netanyahu, given his attempts and his policies as he tries to threaten the regional security.
Qatar has hosted the senior political leadership of Hamas for years, and it's played an important role as one of the key mediating countries trying to bring about an end to the war in Gaza. Qatar is also an ally of the United States, hosting its largest military base in the Middle East. Majid Al-Ansari says Israel has sent a clear message and the Gulf should retaliate.
Netanyahu said himself that he will reshape the Middle East. Does he mean that he's also going to reshape the Gulf region? I think that we have reached a decisive moment. There should be retaliation from the whole region in the face of those barbaric actions that only reflects one thing. It reflects the barbarism of this person that is leading the region to, unfortunately, to a point where we cannot address any situation and we cannot repair anything and we cannot work within the frameworks of international laws.
The reaction from Qatar's neighbours has been swift. Saudi Arabia said it would deploy all capabilities to support Qatar. Egypt, another country that hosts Hamas leaders, said the attack sets a dangerous precedent. The United Arab Emirates has called it treacherous. Mahema Abu Sada is a Palestinian political analyst originally from Gaza. He says Hamas is in deep trouble.
I have to admit and say, Nicole, that Hamas is in a very difficult situation. Most of their military leadership in Gaza have been killed, assassinated. We are only talking about only one top Hamas leader, who is Izzeddin al-Haddad, who is leading Hamas military wing in Gaza. Israel over the past 23 months have killed many of their political leaders, Ismail Haniyeh, Saleh al-Arouri, Yahya Sinwar, supposedly as a leader of the Hamas political bureau in Gaza.
At the start of the war, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would go after the leaders of Hamas wherever they are. It is now on notice. Its leaders are an Israeli target.
Nicole Johnston there. Nepal's Prime Minister has resigned, with the capital erupting in celebration, but deadly anti-corruption protests are continuing in the city streets. South Asia correspondent Meghna Bali reports from Kathmandu.
This is the moment Nepal's Prime Minister KP Sharma Oli resigned. In the centre of Kathmandu, a crowd cries out in victory as a young protester smashes the window of a car. They're shouting, KP Chor, Desh Chor, calling Mr. Oli a thief and demanding he leave the country. But many, like young student Mandeep, say his resignation isn't enough.
If he's dead, then he's a crime minister. He's not a prime minister and he needs to be arrested. We need blood, blood, blood.
The unrest began on Monday, a week after the government banned social media platforms, including Facebook. Officials say it was to curb misinformation. Protesters, like Shishir Bishwakarma, saw it as an attempt to silence a growing online anti-corruption movement.
For the first time, our generation has taken to the streets against corruption and the arbitrary use of state power. I came to show my solidarity with that.
Police responded with batons, tear gas, rubber bullets, and in some cases, live rounds. More than 20 people were killed, hundreds injured. A day later, crowds stormed Parliament, smashing windows, scrawling graffiti, and setting parts of the building ablaze. They freed prisoners from jails, looted police stations, and torched the Prime Minister's private residence. Television footage showed protesters overturning furniture and hurling rocks while outnumbered police looked on.
Yes, it is justified because
this is 22-year-old protester Darshana Padal. She says their anger reflects years of corruption, poverty, and the sense that politicians have been enriching themselves while ordinary people struggle.
People are facing poverty here. The development has not been happening all over these years. These politicians are keeping all the money, international money, all the loans in their pockets.
Nepal has cycled through more than a dozen prime ministers since becoming a republic in 2008. The constant jockeying for power has left many, especially the young, deeply disillusioned. Now, senior politicians may be fleeing, and with the president scrambling to appoint a successor, it's unclear who's in charge. For now, the army chief has appealed to citizens to maintain peace and security. This is Meghna Bali reporting for AM.
Federal government's launching an online hub today to help young Australians know how to party safely while travelling overseas. It's in response to the deaths of Australian teenagers Bianca Jones and Holly Bowles in Laos last year. They died after drinking poisoned drinks. Political reporter Romy Stevens.
It's been less than a year since Sean Bowles lost his daughter Holly.
We have a huge void in our lives. Every day is up and down. And at times, it's been unbearable.
The Melbourne teen died following a mass methanol poisoning incident in the Laos tourist town of Vung Vieng. It also claimed the life of the friend she was backpacking with, 19-year-old Bianca Jones.
I think it's been what no one should have to go through. Our lives are very, very different.
The deaths sparked an outpouring of grief, and since then, the federal government's increased efforts to protect young Australians overseas. It's announced a new online partying safely hub on the Smart Traveller website, aimed at equipping parents and educators with the tools they need to speak to kids about travelling safely while away from home. Sean Bowles says he backs anything that can get parents to have a conversation with their kids.
This is not something that any parent should have to go through. So any initiative that is happening that can open the eyes of young travellers heading overseas to the risks that are involved, we support.
Were you aware of the risks of methanol poisoning before Holly went overseas?
No, we weren't.
But Sean Bowles says the information also needs to go directly to teenagers through the school curriculum and social media.
It needs to be drummed into kids at a young age. Social media, travel forums, Facebook traveller groups, forums like that, that's what kids are on these days. So you need to target kids to what they're looking at.
As well as alcohol safety and methanol poisoning facts, the Partying Safely Hub will also provide information on drugs and travel insurance. Beck Gilchrist is from youth support program Red Frogs, which helped develop the site.
For parents, often it can be so overwhelming as to what to talk about with your young person. So I'm hoping that this hub really streamlines that information and makes it really simple to start the conversation.
Sean Bowles says the government has put a lot of effort into awareness, but he wants to see more done to get justice for the teens.
We still have no answers, whether it be the Lao government or our government, on where the investigation is at, which is really, really disappointing.
The federal government says it's consistently called for a transparent and thorough investigation into the deaths of Bianca Jones and Holly Bowles.
Romy Stevens there. Now that Victoria has become the first parliament in Australia to pass a treaty with First Nations people, attention's turning to whether similar steps can be taken in other states or territories or even at a federal level. Indigenous Affairs reporter Dana Morse.
Back in 1988, all those talking politicians.
A hit song born of a broken promise that renewed a national Indigenous rights movement, finally coming to pass.
I commend the bill to the House.
The Victorian Parliament going where no Australian government has gone before, making a treaty with First Nations people. It's a historic moment, emerging out of decades of failure. As Yothu Yindi sang, back in 1988, then Prime Minister Bob Hawke travelled to the Burunga Festival in the Northern Territory, where he made a promise to Indigenous Australians.
There shall be a treaty.
Yinya Gulia was a young delegate of the Northern Land Council in the crowd at Burunga when Bob Hawke made a promise he didn't keep.
And that was very, very exciting. But after that, it was just like a writing in the sand.
Elected as an independent member for the Northern Territory on a treaty platform, Mr. Gulia says seeing treaty move forward in Victoria is momentous. But in his home territory, the CLP government scrapped the Northern Territory treaty process at the start of the year.
They didn't wanted to have a bar of it, and that was disgusting, and we were really disappointed and upset.
It's not just the NT shutting down treaty processes. Governments in Queensland and Tasmania have also walked back commitments recently. A previous South Australian government abandoned its treaty process in 2018, but the Malinauskas government promised to restart the process in its first term. Little progress has been made so far. New South Wales is in the early stages of its treaty consultations. In Victoria, it took almost 10 years for the state government to arrive at a treaty with the First Nations community. Former Indigenous Australians Minister Linda Burney says that timeline is the norm when it comes to treaty making.
In Canada, for example, I think the Alberta one that's just been arrived at took something like 13 years. It is a slow process that involves many, many people and lots of good faith negotiation, quite frankly.
At a federal level, the government has had little to say on the potential for a national treaty since the loss of the Voice referendum. But Indigenous Australians Minister Malindiri McCarthy has said the government is aware it must take the country with them on any move forward, with a suggestion that there may be a role for national truth-telling in the future.
Indigenous Affairs reporter Dana Morse. The federal government's now acknowledging music therapy by qualified individuals can be as effective as other counselling services and should be paid a similar rate. That's a major change of heart. A year ago, the government flagged it wanted to slash the amount music and art therapists were paid under the National Disability Insurance Scheme, arguing there was little proof therapies were beneficial. But a review out today has found they can be effective. With more, here's National Disability Affairs reporter Naz Campanella.
For a long time, Sarah Cooper's daughter Emma struggled with speech and regulating her emotions. She says after starting music and art therapy, things began to improve.
For Emma, it's really an alternative to something like talk therapy. Emma was really withdrawn. She was very shy. Something like art and music therapy means that there's a medium there that bridges a gap for Emma.
7-year-old Emma is autistic and has been doing the therapies for almost 3 years.
Through art and music, Emma has developed really impressive amount of self-awareness. She also has built up her confidence. Basic things like turn-taking and following direction from a teacher. She just is coping so much better at school now than she ever would have been without music and art.
Last year, the federal government announced it was slashing the maximum hourly rate music and art therapists could charge participants on the NDIS from $194 an hour to $68 an hour, unless they could prove the therapy was improving a participant's functional capacity. That sparked backlash, with families concerned their loved ones would no longer be able to access the therapies using their NDIS funding, and providers fearing their businesses would become unviable.
Hi, this is Paul Dempsey from Something for Kate.
Hi there, I'm Bernard Planning.
Hi, it's Stella Donnelly here.
The outcry even saw musicians speak out via an online video.
I'm here to talk and support registered music therapists working within the NDIS.
A review of the decision led by health economist Stephen Duckett released today has made 19 recommendations, including that music and art therapists can charge a maximum amount of just over $156 an hour. The fee is in line with the maximum payment rate for counselling, and in order to bill that amount, therapists needed to be qualified with a recognised professional association. The NDIS Minister is Jenny McAllister.
Dr. Duckett's report makes clear that art and music therapy, done right, can be effective and beneficial for people in the right circumstances.
Figures in the review show more than 6,500 NDIS participants accessed art therapy in 2023-24, while more than 7,000 did music therapy in that same time. Minister McAllister says the decision today provides a clear way forward for participants and the sector.
It's really important that participants are able to use the resources that they have in their plan to obtain therapies that are really going to be beneficial to them. And we also want to make sure that participants are paying a fair price.
The new pricing comes into effect on the 24th of November.
Naz Campanella reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. At 94, Rupert Murdoch has finally achieved his ultimate succession plan. Media mogul has secured a deal to have his son Lachlan take complete control of his empire once he dies. Today, journalist Paddy Manning on the deal and what it means for the media landscape. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.